accession number 20886, reel 3.
Captain Bryson, reel 3.
They would try and find out how long the ship was going to be there, because the convoys were running about every 2 weeks, and ships that had discharged were taken away and back into the convoys. But as I say, we were there for alongside about 5-6 weeks discharging this aviation spirit. And what they did was they took us into a class to try and teach us Russian, which I'm afraid wasn't very successful. They also had dances at this Inter-East club. They'd arrange a dance, and but you didn't know when the dance was. They wouldn't tell you, and you arrived because you had an issue of leather sea boots. And you'd get these, when you went ashore, you'd go in with these leather sea boots on. And, of course, you'd find out there was a dance and there was a umpire band there. And they'd start playing Roll Out the Barrel. And the dance started and it would finish about an hour later. And that was just one dance. And you just went 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, all around the room to this umpire band. But another time they put a concert on for us, and they brought the artist, or so they said, up from Moscow. And we went to this concert, but there was a curfew on, and we weren't allowed ashore after 11 o'clock at night. And from 11 o'clock till 6 o'clock in the morning, there was a curfew. And this concert didn't finish till just after 11. And so, of course, all the seafarers that were there had to spend the night. And they wouldn't allow us out until 6 o'clock the next morning to go back to the ship. So we had to spend the night, all the girls and that were usually there, they all went home. But all the seamen had to stay there. And they let us out at 6 o'clock in the morning. Another thing was that I was quite friendly with one of the girls up there at the dances and that. And they'd allow you to walk them to the end of the road. Now, when you went out of the club, there was one of the OGPU, the secret police. We used to call them the YMCA. And there was always one followed you. And then at the end of the road, you'd say good night, and you'd go back to the ship, and she'd go home. But I quite enjoyed it up there, really. It was very cold, of course, but all the houses were there were only wooden huts, and they had a stove inside, and the chimney of the stove came out of an open window. One of the windows was broken, so as that the smoke could come outside. It wasn't through the roof or anything, and of course, the wind used to blow through the broken window. But they were very poor. They didn't have an awful lot. But it was not too bad. I quite enjoyed it. They gave you rubles, so many rubles for going up there. You couldn't change money. And they gave you, I think it was the crew that gave 200 rubles, and the officers they gave 400 rubles. Well, we only got 200 rubles, the two apprentices. But the second mate, who we used to call when the alarm went and that, he gave us his 400, so we each had 400, and we, you know, did all right. We managed to get things and that, not to buy anything, but stamps, and you could have a meal in this Inter-East club.
Why did he give you his money?
Well, I suppose for thanking us for calling him out each time. But he never went ashore. He didn't want to go ashore. He was 64, but 64 in those days, I think, is a lot different to being 64 these days. I mean, I'm 75 now, but I remember when I was young and people at 75, they were really old. Well, I don't think I'm really old yet. And then we sailed from Murmansk, again with the icebreakers, took us out, and we joined up with the convoy from Murmansk. We came home and we had very, very bad weather coming home. But when we sailed from Molotovsk, we ballasted the ship with water to keep the propeller down. And when we got out into clear water and the convoy started going, and it was supposed to be a 10-knot convoy, and we couldn't keep up with it. And so, because there was something wrong with the propeller, I knew that. And so what we did was we stopped and tipped the ship up, pumped the ballast out aft, and we only had three stubs, really, and half a blade. And so, of course, it wouldn't drive the ship through the water. We ballasted back, and the convoy had slowed down for us, and we got in with the convoy again, and the convoy speed was up to what we could do, really, because with the propeller we couldn't go. There was a lot of vibration in the ship. We got back to Glasgow. We tipped the ship once again in Glasgow and showed the propeller, because they wanted us to go across to New York straight away. And we tipped the ship, and that was it. So they saw the propeller, and so they didn't have a dry dock in Glasgow at all that could take us, not for a week or so. And so they sent us down to Liverpool. And we went into Camelot. We got into Liverpool in the morning, early in the morning, berthed, docked right into Camelot's dry dock. And they took the cast iron propeller off the deck. You always carried a spur in those days. They took the cast iron off, propeller off the deck, and put that on, took the bronze propeller off, and put the cast iron one on. And that just took a day. And the next day, we were out of dry dock and sailed for New York. We loaded in New York again. Same aviation spirit, and we naturally thought we were going up to Russia again, but of course shortly after we sailed, it was VE Day, the war in Europe was over, and so we were in thick fog at the time. But when I was on the lookout in the crow's nest, and you could see all the masts of the ship, of the ships in the convoy, but you couldn't see the actual ships. It was just a low fog. And once you were up the mast, which was only, 100 feet above, it was clear as a bell. You could just see the masts sticking out of the fog. And then we heard all the celebrations in America. You could still get the American stations in Halifax, Nova Scotia, you could still get the radio stations. And we heard all the celebrations going on and that, and then on the overseas service from England. And we got back and went to Stanlow, Ellesmere Port, and we discharged there. And then I left the ship, and because I had the sea time in for my certificate, my indentures didn't finish until November, but this was May, and I had the sea time in, so they sent me for my second mate certificate, relieved me. And so, of course, I was home then for VJ Day, August. I got my ticket in the September, and I went back to sea as third mate, but then the war was over. And that was the first time, when I was third mate of a ship, was the first time that I'd seen navigation lights on a ship. All through the war, we didn't have navigation lights. And that was the first time I'd had them. And that was the end of the war then, of course. That was it.
So, presumably, Empire Flint belonged to a different line?
No, no. Run by the Athol Line. Owned by the government, but it was managed by the Athol Line. And after the war, the Athol Line bought her and renamed her the Athelstane, I think it was, as a one of their own ships. And they ran her for a while, only about 3 or 4 years, because there was a shortage of ships, of course, after the war. And then she was sold to the Italians.
How did conditions in Empire Flint compare with those in the previous ship?
Well, they were good, but there was one thing. On that ship, you had the third officer, the chief officer, the second officer, and then the apprentice's room. But you had no separate bathroom. The apprentice's room had four bunks in it, because there should have been, generally there was four apprentices on a ship. But there was only the two of us, and so we had the top bunk each in this room. And the inside of the ports were about, when we were up there, were about 3 inches thick with ice on the inside of the portholes. You couldn't open your ports or anything. But and we used to use the officer's toilet, bathroom. Well, that ship had running water, of course, because she was a modern ship, built during the war, 1943, I think she was built. And we used the, as I say, the officer's toilet. Well, we used to be working on deck, and then you'd come off deck at 2:45 and have a cup of tea or a cup of coffee or whatever. And at 3 o'clock, you're supposed to be back at work again. We used to call it smoko. And this other apprentice, he went to the toilet in our break, see. And unfortunately, the mate woke up and wanted to go to the toilet. So he went in to the toilet and, of course, tried the door. And Bennett was still in there. And so he came out. He thought somebody else was in there. That's all right. And about 10 minutes later, he came back again and knocked on, found the door locked. And he knocked on it noisily and found out who was in there, you see. Which Bennett the apprentice, who was reading a book. Anyway, we got banned from using the officer's toilet. Now, at the entrance on the bridge aft, there was the entrance into the officer's accommodation. Just alongside of it was a toilet, an outside toilet. And so we were made to use the outside toilet. The chief officer was very annoyed over this, and he made us use the outside toilet. Well, when the temperature is 50 degrees below and you're right facing the deck, and of course all steel doors, steel bulkheads, you can imagine what it was like. And I'm afraid It wasn't very nice.
How do you feel now about having served in the Merchant Navy in the war?
Oh, I feel quite good. I'm pleased that I did. I went to the Merchant Navy service in Liverpool Cathedral yesterday afternoon. They always have a service every year on the Armistice Sunday. And 1 year it's in the Anglican Cathedral, and which it was this year. Next year it's in the Catholic Cathedral.
What do you think, obviously you didn't serve in the Royal Navy, but what do you think about the comparison between the fate of the Royal Navy sailor and the Merchant Navy sailor in the war?
Well, I think that, you see, during the war, the merchant seamen were looked down upon by the majority of people and the majority of the forces, the Navy and that. They were looked down upon, really. You heard about the white feathers and all this sort of thing, because you had an MN, they brought the MN badge out to show that you were in the MN. But even so, they still thought it was an easy job. But they forgot that the ship, the submarines and the aircraft that were attacking you were trying to get the merchant ships. They weren't going for the escorts. I mean, all you've got to look at is look at the losses. Throughout the war, it was what? Well, they've just started this Arboretum down in Staffordshire, and there's nearly 3,000 trees going up for each ship that was lost. But and even in the clubs, in the Russian Convoy Club and the North Russia Club, as the North Russia Club mainly, even though you're in the club and you're in the same as they are, they don't seem to think that you should be recognised the same as they were recognised. And they were only hostilities only. I went to sea as a career. I served 39 years at sea. So, but they were hostilities only, nearly all of them. Well, you'd say 80% of them at least. That's all they were. So I think we were looked down upon. But it's since the Battle of the Atlantic at the service in Liverpool, when the Archbishop of York gave his sermon, I think that changed people's ideas.
The 50th anniversary.
Yeah, of the Battle of the Atlantic, 1993. I think that changed people's ideas. People didn't know that if you were torpedoed, the day you were torpedoed, your pay stopped. And you were in an open boat maybe for 10 days, 15 days after. You didn't get paid for that. And people then started to realise what it was really like at sea.